From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The fiscal cliff negotiations have put the size of your future Social Security check on the table to shave it maybe just a little with a new, less generous way of calculating inflation. The chained CPI, it's called. It would shave Social Security payments by an estimated $112 billion over 10 years. Whether that's easy money off the budget or a big betrayal depends on where you stand, but it would, sooner or later, affect everyone. This hour on Point, the chained CPI and Social Security payments in the mix on the fiscal cliff. You can join the conversation. Is there room in seniors' budgets for a bit of belt tightening? Is this a sacrifice we need to make instead of raising taxes? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We will hear in this hour from liberal thinker Bob Kuttner, from conservative thinker Jason Fichtner. But first, joining me from Washington to set the table is Henry Aaron, senior fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institution. Henry Aaron, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
So this is looking at changing the way we calculate inflation, so it would change how much Social Security checks grow over time as inflation bites in, right?
That's part of the story. The alternative index would grow a bit more slowly than the price index now in use, and that means that the annual inflation adjustment in Social Security would in most years be a bit smaller than it now is. That, however, is not the end of the story. This price index, the consumer price index, is used in a wide range of federal programs. So one of the critical issues in the current discussion is whether, if the index is replaced, it would be replaced not just for Social Security,
right,
but for taxes, for supplemental security income, the income-tested program for the poor, and for many other provisions in the federal expenditure listing.
Just to boil that down,
affected by the CPI.
Right. It would mean lower Social Security payments. The checks would be smaller. It would mean higher taxes because you wouldn't get bumped. You'd get bumped up into higher brackets. Therefore, it's complicated, but it would end up meaning higher taxes along the way as people's incomes rose. So it kind of bites at both ends. I want to look at the Social Security piece just for a second here, because the way the inflation is calculated, the way it comes out lower, is interesting. And right now it's calculated on a basket of goods. As those rise, so do the payments that go out to our seniors. And, I mean, when you look at this, AARP, which doesn't like this, as you know, but the Social Security, they say, is the principal source of income for two-thirds of older American households. About a third depend on Social Security for basically all their income. So every little bit matters here. And it is not a lot of money for those households living on it. And the idea here is that, let's say the price of beef goes up. In this new calculation, they're assuming, well, you don't have to eat beef. You can eat chicken, or you can eat pork, or you can eat goat, or you can eat something else. Am I right?
That's correct. The argument is, and I think for the mass of the population, it's a valid argument. If the price of one particular good goes up, we can adjust to some degree by switching what we buy. And that's the source of the difference between these two indices. But there's something else about this particular modification in Social Security that I think is troubling. The price index is used each year for adjusting benefits to offset inflation. Every year, the index would be a little bit smaller, and therefore the increase in benefits would accumulate over time.
So the older you got, the more you'd feel it.
That's correct. But if you were a retiree, by the time you hit age 85, the cumulative effect would be that your annual benefits would be about 1 month smaller. You'd be getting 11 months rather than 12 months benefits.
Because you start out wherever the market is, and then gradually this less accommodation for inflation would bite in, so that by the time you're in your 80s, that's like losing a month's check out of every year, which is pretty big, which means, in effect, the weight of this would fall most heavily, if I'm following you, Henry Aaron, on the oldest and, I guess, the poorest Americans.
Well, most have it's proportional. It would affect everybody proportionately, of course, for
but
those who depend
you
exclusively
get.
On Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
The impact on your total income is that much larger.
Why is this on the table in these negotiations?
Because various study groups have observed that the alternative index for the mass of the population is a better measure of what it takes to maintain a standard of living. Now,
I'm sorry, I didn't follow what you just said. You're saying the chain CPI is more accurate or is it better for maintaining a standard of living? How is moving me from beef to goat improving my standard of living?
It's not improving. It's a question of whether you can get your protein from chicken instead of a beef or from
escargot, different slugs.
The argument is that this index for the mass of the population, on balance, is a better measure of what it takes to maintain your standard of living.
With respect, I don't think that's why this is on the table. They're trying to make a deal in Washington. Why has the deal-making put this on the table?
The deal-making has put it on the table because the alternative index would result in lower spending. And many groups are looking for ways to cut Social Security or Medicare. If one can invoke a allegedly superior measure of inflation as a way of doing it, then one isn't cutting benefits. One is simply doing something one set out to do initially, which is to keep them constant as people grow older.
Except they wouldn't
doing
be
it
constant,
more accurately.
As you said. Well, okay, but I mean that's a matter of opinion, right? And it's also, I suppose, just in political terms, it's kind of complicated. It's hard to follow, and so you can cut without people exactly getting what's going on. Maybe we need to. But in the back and forth, why is this on the table? Is this a kind of quid pro quo? The president puts this out there. We're going to trim entitlements, Republicans. And so you're going to raise taxes on the wealthy? Is that what's going on? Obama, Boehner, Boehner, Obama here?
The president didn't put this on the table. Mr. Boehner did. The question was whether Mr. Boehner had to have something in the way of entitlement cuts. In order for him to persuade his caucus mm-hmm. that some increase in taxes was acceptable. I think what the president has at least tentatively decided is that if you have to give some ground, this may be not the worst way to do it. And on that, there's a mm-hmm. good deal of disagreement because there, as it happens, the elderly actually consume a different bundle of goods than the typical non-elderly American does.
In what way?
And they consume more health care, and they spend
sure.
a great deal
okay.
more on it. And
right.
health care actually has been getting expensive faster than other things have.
So even if chicken or pork or goat is cheaper than something else you might eat for protein, your health care bills are going up faster than regular inflation. So that means the bite may even be harder.
Exactly right. There is a special index that's been calculated for the elderly, and rather than growing less rapidly than the consumer price index now in use, it grows more rapidly. So if you applied an allegedly more accurate price index for the elderly to Social Security, you'd actually bump up the growth of benefits for inflation from year to year.
But we've got a problem here. We've got some kind of stalled negotiation, or very difficult negotiation. People want to see something on the entitlement side. John Boehner seems to. The president seems to be, maybe, as you say, going along with this, maybe to get something done. Henry Aaron, please stand by there in Washington. Joining me now in the studio is Robert Kuttner, co-editor of the American Prospect, one of the key voices on the left defending Social Security as it stands. His essay Tuesday was Social Security, Will Obama Cave? Robert Kuttner, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
I don't know if cave is the right word or make a savvy compromise. Do you think President Obama is endorsing this change in Social Security payments?
Well, he has said that before Boehner pulled the rug out from under him yet again, he said that
with Plan B,
mm-hmm. that switching to a different index, the so-called chained consumer price index, mm-hmm. That would be okay, even though, as Henry Aaron just said, it is a kind of disguised backdoor way of cutting Social Security.
Is this a cut we need to take? Everybody's got to share and feel the pain. The country's in a pickle.
No, because ordinary people have already tightened their belts a lot. Ordinary people have had a terrible decade, and gazillionaires are making more money than ever. So the idea that everybody should share the pain is a little silly because the pain has already been maldistributed. But I want to make just a couple of basic points. First of all, I want to reinforce, Tom, what you said about chicken isn't beef. The idea that you're maintaining your social, your standard of living by being forced to convert to products that are not as good as the products that you used to be able to buy, and somehow that's okay, that should not be the premise.
Maybe we're not a beef-level country anymore. Seriously, I mean, people talk about Greece. What are they eating in Greece now? I don't know. I mean,
don't fiddle with the numbers. Don't fiddle with the index and pretend they're equivalent when they're not equivalent. Mm-hmm. Secondly, as Henry said, the situation of older people is rather different than the situation of younger people. I mean, if you were a 65-year-old in 2006, you would say to yourself, all right, here's my plan. I'm going to sell my house. I'm going to put the money in a savings account. Yep. I'm going to get interest on savings. I'm going to collect Social Security. Well, your house is now worth 30% less than it was. The prevailing interest rates may be 1%.
Yeah.
So your situation is a lot worse. And as Henry Aaron said, you're spending more money on health care. If anything, your consumer price index is worse than the average bear.
And you may be really depending on that Social Security check. Bob Kuttner, please stand by. Henry Aaron in Washington. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a change in Social Security that is in the mix right now in the fiscal cliff talks, bringing on the chained CPI, chained consumer price index, a new, less generous, maybe more accurate, you decide, way of calculating inflation in setting Social Security payments. The AARP has argued strongly against pegging the growth in Social Security payments to the chained CPI. Here in an outline video, the AARP makes its case.
Washington politicians who support this cut want you to believe they're trying to make a tiny change in the way your benefits are calculated. But in a letter we sent to Congress and the President, AARP pointed out that the proposed cut, called chained CPI, will take $112 billion from current retirees in the next 10 years alone.
Henry Aaron is with us, Senior Fellow in Economic Studies at the Brookings Institution, joining us today from Washington. Robert Kuttner is with us, co-editor of The American Prospect. You can link to his recent essay on all this at our website, onpointradio.org, is the author of A Presidency in Peril. And right now, joining us from Washington is Jason Fichtner, Senior Research Fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. He served in several positions at the Social Security Administration from 07 to 2010. Jason Fichtner, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Tom, and hello, Hank, and hello, Bob.
It's good to have you all. Jason, give us your perspective here. Is it right to have this on the table? Is it right to have seniors' Social Security payments, and I guess everybody's sooner or later, trimmed a little bit to get us onto a fiscal cliff agreement?
So let's just sort of step back a minute and talk about why do we have a cost of living allowance adjustment anyway for Social Security?
Isn't that obvious?
Well, that's the point. The obvious answer is to maintain purchasing power for beneficiaries.
Yeah.
And then the idea is that how do we do that the most accurate way possible? And we should be focusing on the most accurate measure. And the current measure is basically assumed by most economists, not all, but most economists, to overstate inflation. Now, you can question whether that is the same applied to those who are on disability, those who are seniors, or just applies to the average 40-year-old and nobody else. But the goal should be to have the most accurate measure of inflation possible.
Well, let me poke at that for just a minute here, Jason. I mean, first on the accuracy side, people use that word, and maybe that's right, but I understand the chain CPI is, I don't know if it's about accuracy, it's about human nature. And it says when certain things become more expensive, people can and will use other things. But isn't that a way of, couldn't that be just a way of ratcheting down your standard of living? Don't eat beef, eat pork, eat chicken, eat goat, you know, our listeners are writing in here. Mike says, seniors don't need to eat beef, not when there's so many yummy choices from Purina and Calcan pet food. Megan says, what's wrong with goat? I mean, actually, goat's kind of tasty, but isn't it a change in quality of life implicit when you downgrade from the more expensive items?
So I'm glad you brought this up, Tom, because the way the chain CPI works is it actually looks at how you, as a consumer, change your behavior because of prices. It doesn't force you to change. So if beef goes up, the government doesn't say, oh, beef's gone up, you must now eat chicken because it costs less.
No, but you won't have the money to buy it with this lower payment.
It's measuring it first. If people decide, wait a minute, the cost of living has gone up on beef, and they make a choice to actually consume less beef, that would then show up in the chain CPI.
I mean, I get it. That's a distinction. I'm not sure it's a difference, though. I mean, people might prefer beef, but they might eat goat because they can't afford it. And what about the other piece here on the health care costs? That the elderly spend more on health care, and the inflation rate there is actually higher than standard inflation.
No, and that's a good point. So just to backtrack, when people said beef went up, they might buy less shorts, you know, or shorts or tennis shoes to pay for beef. And they're looking at there's another measure of inflation called the CPIE, which is experimental or for the elderly, which takes into account that the elderly may spend more on health care than I would do as a 41-year-old or someone else would do as a 12-year-old, and tries to take that into account. And I did a short paper on this last year looking at what would happen if we did the cost of living based on the chain CPI or the CPIE again for the elderly. And a great example is if you look back in 2008, we had all those increases in gas prices.
Yeah.
The COLA the following year was 5.8%. So it's a very high anomaly, but it was 5.8%.
Yeah.
Had we used the chain CPI, it would have been 5.2%. Had we gone to the CPIE, it would be 5.1%, a little bit less than the chain CPI.
Because elders don't drive as much as others? Is that your point?
Energy prices went up, but at that point, healthcare prices started declining a little bit, and we saw more use of generics.
Is the AARP off base here, Jason? I mean, they say, quoting from them here, a typical 80-year-old woman will lose the equivalent of 3 months' worth of food annually. That sounds like a big deal.
So let's put this back in perspective. They're accumulating this over time, depending on when a person started benefits, whether it's 62, 65, 66.
Yeah, yeah.
I just ran some numbers that says, what is it today? So if you go on the Social Security's website, they said the average benefit for retired workers, so now we're talking about an average worker who's retired, is $1,240.
Per month.
$1,240 per month.
That is not exactly extravagant.
It is not by any means. If you add your 1.7% COLA, which is now what they're supposed to get come January 2013, it goes up to $1,261, so a $21 per month change.
Yep.
If we move to a chain CPI, that figure would be anywhere between $1,256 or maybe a little higher, but you're talking about now a $2 to $5 difference a month. And again, everyone's took it to a larger benefit increase each year.
I mean, when you're working and everything else, that sounds like no big deal, but somehow when AARP puts it in terms of 3 months' worth of food for an 80-year-old woman, it sounds desperate. Why that gap, Jason?
Well, because they're focusing on now a 25-year accumulation, and Henry Aaron made this point earlier about if you take this over time, the gap grows.
But shouldn't we think about that, about the 80-year-old woman who and her 3 months' worth of food gone?
Well, I don't think that's actually the right way of looking at it. It's sort of like saying to your...
If you're 80, it might be.
Well, but think about this. If we're all working, so let's sort of change the dynamics a little bit. Okay. What if I had expected next year to get a 10% raise from my boss? And it only gives me a 5% rate.
But we're not all working. She's not working. That 80-year-old woman, well, she might be these days, but most likely she's not working.
No, but she's also changing her behavior because of price changes. And I think the thing is, how do we do that the most accurate measure possible?
If she's making $1,200 a month, how much room for behavior change do you think she's got?
Well, again, when you're talking about a few dollars a month, and I know every dollar counts. I'm not trying to say it doesn't.
Yeah.
But this is where you start thinking about, can people make changes in their behavior, or are they already doing it? So forget for a minute that someone gets a COLA. Before they get a cost of living increase in January, throughout the previous year, people, whether they're 25, 45, 65, 80, are already making consumption pattern changes based on the change in prices. They're already making that behavior. All the CPI, the chain CPI is doing is trying to model that and say, we've seen what you've done, and now we're going to accurately reflect that with the cost of living.
Jason, I want to get Bob and Henry, Aaron in here, but let me just ask you, is it your estimation that we need this as a country, that we can't, you know, we've got a fiscal crisis and we've got to do this because we don't have a choice? Or is this a choice? Could we do it some other way that would not be so ultimately tough on that poorest 86-year-old woman or man?
Well, I think this is a first step, and I think Bob
first
and Henry,
step
and
toward
gonna,
what?
I'm going to agree with them that we want to try to make sure we protect the most vulnerable in our society. So I'm actually a proponent of moving to the chain CPI, but then also looking at it, is there a better way to have, say, a minimum benefit or change the benefit formula for those who are on SSI or DI or at the lower ends of retirement, so that they actually get a better benefit outside of what we do with the CPI.
Yeah, it's we want to look closely at this because it is obvious from these numbers. When you get to a certain age, your income is fixed and you're depending on this, and millions of people do, Every dollar is a big deal. Bob Cutner, do we need to do this?
You know,
we do, that's one thing. I mean, seniors are citizens, they care about the country, but do we need to do this?
Well, I don't think we need to do this, and I just want to reinforce something you were getting at about choice. Conservative economists can be very cavalier about this concept of choice because choice often exists under coerced conditions. If you see a homeless person sleeping under a bridge, and you're that sort of economist, you can say, well, he made a free choice not to stay at the Holiday Inn. But it's not exactly a free choice in the same way.
Because he's broke, maybe.
Because he's broke. In the same way that if you take away part of somebody's Social Security check, forcing them to choose to stop eating hamburger and eating cat food or whatever it happens to be, that's not a free choice. That's a choice that's compelled by reduced resources.
But we don't want to put it in cat food terms unless we have to. I mean, we know we've got problems here in this country.
But the point is the so-called choice.
Yeah.
Is not the sort of free choice that economists talk about.
Because you've got economic necessity at your back.
And the necessity is the consequence of the proposed policy. Now, my beef here, no pun intended,
or goats,
Social Security should not be part of this conversation at all. This is a conversation, don't forget, the context for this is the president's negotiations with Speaker Boehner.
Yeah.
That's a conversation about reducing the deficit.
Yeah.
Social Security is in surplus. People like me would say there should be a very bright line here. We should be talking about lots of other things, but don't put Social Security into this
mix. White House doesn't seem to have that bright line because this number, $112 billion, they're throwing that in with the savings that would result from this potential deal.
Well, as Henry said, Speaker Boehner threw it in, and then the White House said, well, okay, if you do other things, maybe we could live with that.
If you say okay, you say okay.
Well, I think that's bad tactics on the White House's part. I think the White House was very shrewd to say, sorry, Medicare is not going to be in this mix. I think it would also be smarter if the White House drew a very bright line on Social Security, let the Republicans bear the onus for putting Social Security into the pot, because Social Security is not part of what's driving the deficit.
Well, I mean, so you say. We hear it the other way from a lot of Republicans. Henry Aaron, what about it? If the president is prepared to include these savings from changing what how much is in the checks that go out to Social Security recipients, is that rightly calculated as a savings here as a spending cut in these negotiations?
I'd like to make two points, Tom. Mm-hmm. First, I want to go back to this issue of accuracy of indices. Mm-hmm. I frankly don't care a great deal about the accuracy of the indices relative to another question. The question is, is this way of cutting Social Security, if you stipulate cuts are necessary, is this a sensible way to go about doing it? And it isn't.
Why?
It isn't because no sensible person would say the older you get, the larger your reduction in benefits will be, despite the fact that the rate of poverty goes up as people get older.
So why are people signing on to this? Why have you signed on to it, kind of, Henry?
I think that we face a critical and very dangerous situation at this time. Mm-hmm. I think, namely with respect to a whole bunch, half a dozen or eight different events that are happening at the end of the year that hold a very serious threat to the U.S. economy. I believe also that some members of participants in the negotiation are taking irresponsible positions that are of great danger to the welfare of the nation. I wish they weren't, but they are. And it is exceedingly important, in my view, that we get an agreement that avoids the very bad fiscal outcomes and very bad economic effects that would ensue if we simultaneously increased taxes a lot and cut spending a lot. If the debt ceiling were not increased, if the long-term unemployed were thrown off of their extended benefits, if Medicare fees for doctors under Medicare were allowed to fall as much as they will under current law, all of these things are happening at year-end.
All in the pipeline with the cliff coming. And so you say, with all that, maybe we've got to do this. I'll come back to you on that, Henry. But Jason, let me ask you, Bob Cutner said Social Security should be exempt from this because it's in surplus until I forget what year, and it shouldn't be on the table here. Is it right to rope Social Security in here, Jason?
So let me answer that in two parts. One, Social Security, the surplus, it's no longer in surplus. There actually is still a trust fund which goes insolvent in 2033. Mm-hmm. But we now are what's called cash flow deficit. When you think about the amount of money coming in payroll taxes are no longer enough to cover the benefits going out. So at some point we start drawing down that trust fund, and when we hit 2033 it becomes insolvent. Mm-hmm. That does not mean bankruptcy. It just means we can't afford to pay all the benefits that are promised. And that's why we have to do something with Social Security when it comes to reform. And my concern is that I do think Social Security should be part of the equation, but I don't think we should single it out. It is not the largest driver of our problems when you think about the health care spending we're doing. And my concern is that even if we do a chain CPI and just focus on Social Security, that people are going to think, oh, wait, we solved the problem and we're done. And that's not right. And Hank's pointing out there's a lot of issues that we're facing right now that are troubling this country and this economy. And I think we need to take a much more holistic look of how we reform Social Security entitlement and our tax code.
Why do you think, and if you don't think it should be singled out, why has it been? Why is it on the table when other things are not? Is it because this, you know, indices change is kind of obscure and people can't really follow it, so you can just throw it in there and nobody will really get it until 20 years from now?
No, I think the honest answer, Tom, is that this is the lowest hanging fruit possible. When you think about the reform options that we put on the table.
Because 85-year-old ladies don't have a lot of clout in Washington, or why?
No, because the actual dollar magnitude of change, as I pointed out to you, on a monthly basis is quite small. And you heard from the APR that the number they put out over 10 years is $110 billion.
Yeah.
Other changes would cost a lot more or save a lot more. The magnitude is much greater. If we can't even do this, there's no way we can do anything else. I think this has been put on the table. We'll put on the table in a modest sense, because we're not sure if Boehner put it out or President Obama, if it's actually being considered.
Right.
But I think it's being floated because if you think about trying to control the cost of growth of entitlement, this is the lowest hanging fruit, I think, possible, along with raising the retirement age. And if we can't even do these, we're not going to be able to do anything else.
Bob Cutner, if we can't do this little tiny change in Social Security, we can't handle the challenges that we're up against fiscally. What about it?
You know, Henry is my friend. I've learned a lot from him over the years. But I think the formulation that Henry just articulated is very risky.
Jason just now, but
no,
both. Yes,
Henry,
before. Okay.
In the following sense, if people say, well, the Republicans are really behaving irresponsibly, I wish they weren't. But because they are willing to play a more dangerous game with the fiscal cliff than President Obama is, we have to give in. We have to blink first.
Republicans might say Democrats are playing a dangerous game. They won't touch entitlements and we can't afford them. That's kind of what we're hearing here from Jason.
But the problem is that if we look at Social Security, which should not be part of this mix at all, it Jason's wrong, by the way, it is in surplus. It is drawing down its own trust funds to pay benefits. That was planned. That doesn't mean it's in deficit. It's still in surplus for the next.
But when you say 2033, that sugar bowl is empty. That's scary. People get that.
You get wage growth back up. You get job growth back up. It won't be empty.
Yeah, okay.
Well, if we ever get a recovery.
Yeah.
But the point is, the fact that the Republicans have created this artificial fiscal cliff does not mean that we ought to give away the store. Just because Boehner is saying, oh, I can't hold my caucus, I'm not sure I can cut a deal, we may go off the cliff. Obama said, I'm not going to negotiate against myself, but guess what? He's negotiating against himself.
And on the table, the legacy of FDR, all the rest you're saying there.
Well, I'm saying Social Security is not part of the problem. It should not be vulnerable to cuts to solve an artificially created cliff.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a change in Social Security that is apparently in the mix in the fiscal cliff talks, bringing on the chained CPI. It's a new, less generous way of calculating inflation in setting Social Security payments. If you're living on those now, depending on them in whole or part, you can imagine what that means. If you're not, one day you probably will, and that may be decided in the next few days in these very tough negotiations around the fiscal cliff. Henry Aaron is with us from the Brookings Institution. Jason Fichtner, who worked in the Social Security Administration, is with us from George Mason University, the Mercatus Center there. Robert Cutner is here, co-editor of the American Prospect. Lots of people responding online. I mean, people are aware that we've got fiscal problems in this country. At the same time, you know, Ellen writes about people being reduced to rice and peanut butter. Julia says, my father, as a farmer, started working at the age of 4 and later served in Vietnam. He's barely surviving off of Social Security and work, please don't make his life unworkable. Well, there's some debate about what's unworkable here. You can substitute. Does that take us to rice and peanut butter? I don't know. Lisa in Newton, Massachusetts is calling. Lisa, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm what's called a disabled adult child. I've been disabled since childhood, and I collect on my parents' Social Security.
Okay.
So I've been collecting since 94, and on the retirement system, it mirrors my parents, and my parents are in their 80s, mm-hmm. frail. So they've got a lot of medical problems. So
yep.
a lot of their income goes towards Medigap Medical.
Mm-hmm.
And they're also helping me out in terms of medical. Now, I live on just over, a little bit over 1,000, like 1,100.
Okay, dollars a month.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we just got this huge whopping increase in ride paratransit service, so that it costs me either $8 or $10, depending on every time that I go somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really hard. So, yeah, I have cut back, but that means cutting back on just doing basic things.
So if we go to this, Lisa, you know, I don't know what you, on the grocery side now, I don't know what you have, but let's say, you know, the idea here is you don't need to eat quite what you're eating. You could eat cheaper things, for example.
Well, no, you see, I'm disabled, and, you know, my cooking skills are pretty small. I actually have to buy some prepared items, okay?
You physically can't do the cooking?
I've got a disability, a cognitive one, too.
Mm-hmm.
It involves chopping and cooking and remembering when things are hot, and it's like brain damage, okay?
Okay.
So, you know, there are special costs for some of us disabled, and I've always lived in the community. My parents have always... So, you know, I suppose if I was not living in a Section 8 supported apartment in the community near my parents and near my other supports, that, you know, maybe some things would be thrown in. But, you know, basically, I've always wanted to have as normal a life as possible and live among my neighbors. And that's what I've been doing.
How much could you cut?
I can't cut anything. My parents helped me out. I mean, I can't cut anything. And they are in their late 80s. My mother has had three kinds of cancer.
Yeah.
My father is having, you know, he worked till last year, by the way. But he's sick now.
Up to his 80s. But what, Lisa, what about...
Late 80s.
Right, and you're looking at that. What about when, you know, we've got problems in this country. You can see that. You may have cognitive issues, but you're smart. It's obvious.
I can see we
have... So what do we do?
These are the wrong people to get money from. I also see, you know, we went to a presentation with Jamie Galbraith, and he was saying, don't let anyone tell you we can't afford an entitlement, you know, entitlements. There are things you can do. There are other things we could do.
Lisa, I appreciate your call. I've got so many more waiting, but thank you very much, and I wish you luck. Let me get one here from Mansfield, Connecticut. Catherine's calling. Catherine, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to say that I really think that entitlement has been made a dirty word, and I don't like that. You know, this money in Social Security, people earned. They saved. It was a savings of sort. It was their earnings that paid for it that went into it.
Every week, every month.
So it isn't right that it's going to come out. And I have a partner who lives on Social Security,
mm-hmm.
and I get Medicare through my former ex-husband who's deceased.
Okay.
Because I was a teacher, and otherwise I wouldn't have Medicare.
Mm-hmm.
And I really think that we are looking at the wrong thing to cut. I mean, this is, in a way, respectfully, this is a ludicrous conversation.
Well, ludicrous, but if it's on the table at the White House in Capitol Hill, we better be talking about it, don't you think?
Yes, that's true. But the point is, military and military affairs and nuclear facilities and programs and so forth take up 60% of our budget.
Right.
War and so forth. Why are we not looking at that with a fine-tooth comb?
Catherine, what do you say to people, and I've read a lot of this in preparing for the show today, who say, well, you know, Social Security was not designed for what it's become. It was put in place in a time when, by the time people, you know, turn 65, their life was about over. It wasn't intended to be something that would support people for 20, 30 years after they stopped working. And we it wasn't intended for that, and we can't afford it.
Yeah, well, fine. I mean, that's a nice philosophical attitude, but I don't think it's going to hold water with anybody. just because it wasn't designed for it originally, perhaps.
Yeah.
Maybe we need to put more money into it because people are living longer. And as your former caller said, Lisa, the expenses get to be more and more. I'm 78 myself, and I go to aquatherapy, and I get a reduced rate, but it costs money to go to aquatherapy so that I can still keep...
That keeps you moving. Catherine, we've got it. Jason Fichtner, what do you hear in these first two calls that we bring in, and particularly in Catherine's, resentment of this sort of demonization of the word entitlement? She said, look, we paid in, and this is the deal, and don't demonize this.
Well, and I think that's a very important point to bring up, because there's a social contract I think we've all made about these programs, that we've paid in, we supported it, we expect to get something back for it. I think there's something that myself, Bob, and Hank would all agree on. I mean, it's a very fundamental principle, is we want to protect those who are the most vulnerable in our society. We want to make sure that happens. What scares me, and I mean this in the word scares me, is if we don't make any changes, say, we're again, talking about a change CPI, I don't like to use the word cut, because everyone would still get a larger benefit increase than they had before, so it's slowing the growth, but it's not really a cut.
Well, that's semantic. But it's
a semantic, but it's important, because think about what happens if we do nothing, and we get to 2033.
Yeah.
So Bob's banking on higher wage growth. The economy picks up. Rosy times coming.
That would fix it, he says, yeah.
It would help. If it doesn't, though, what happens then? We actually are insolvent. That means everyone gets, at the worst-case scenario, a 25% immediate benefit cut. That $1,240 today is now $930. There's no increase. It's a real cut of one quarter. That scares me. I don't want to get to the point where all of a sudden we're at 2033 and we're having this conversation, Tom. You're saying, wait a minute, we have to cut benefits by a quarter?
Right, we could have shaved it just a little back in 2012 and we didn't, and now we've got to take 25% off?
And now you've got my fear. And that's why I'm fighting so hard for these modest changes which slow the growth but maintain purchasing power higher every year so we can avoid having potentially a real cut down the road.
Henry, Aaron, I'll bring that to you. But Bob, yes, please, Henry. Hank.
I think this is a false crisis. The fact of the matter is we have already cut Social Security benefits. We cut them about 15% back in starting with legislation in 1983. That's being phased in. U.S. benefits are lower than those in 16 out of the 20 other wealthy nations in the world, really dramatically lower. This is a system we can afford as it is. We could easily deal entirely with the projected shortfall in Social Security by raising the proportion of earnings that are covered by the payroll tax.
Don't cap it at 106 or 1,000 or whatever it is. So why is this on the table in that case?
And raise payroll tax rates a very little bit, and the problem that Jason described goes away.
Yeah, but we're not even paying the payroll tax for the last couple of years at all, let alone raise it. But why, if it's a false choice, a false crisis, I mean, why is it on the table?
It's on the table because major participants in the debate have put it on the table.
Why?
Not everybody agrees with Bob and me, or even with Jason, about the importance of this program. There are many people who, going back to the original enactment of the program, thought it was a bad idea and opposed it on philosophical grounds.
Because Americans
they
wouldn't
are
be
today
50
more powerful than they were in the past, and they have put it on the table. I don't think it belongs there as part of the current deficit debate, unfortunately, neither Bob Kuttner nor I are king.
Not everybody would make you guys king. Bob Kuttner, are you flirting with disaster? Jason says, we deny the need to do something today. 2033 comes and boom, we got to take a big whack out of what we can.
As Henry says, there are all kinds of things that are not on the table that ought to be on the table. Well, we have the lowest tax rate on very wealthy people that we've had since World War II. We've got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of billionaires. We have people who make $2 or $3 billion a year, hedge fund traders who contribute nothing to economic welfare in this country. And your last two callers are more representative of the way most people live. 95% of the productivity gain in this country in the past 15 years has gone to the top 1%. The people who are behind the Fix the Debt campaign are people who pay less tax than their secretaries. This is really scandalous. And what are we doing? We're cutting Social Security. So, I mean, to be blunt about it, I think if the President of the United States were a little bit tougher, he's got a very strong hand to play here against the Republicans, because most people don't want their Social Security cut, don't want their parents' or their neighbors' Social Security cut, And if the president simply hung tough here, the Republicans would understand how unpopular their position is because the American people don't want to savage this program.
Jason Fichtner, what about it? Bob Kuttner says we're looking in the wrong place here. We should look in the pockets of deep pockets of billionaires and fix it that way.
Well, I think you asked the question also is why is the tax increases not being put on the table? You know, and you asked this to Henry and to Bob. If you look at what's going on in the negotiations now, President Obama has asked for a $1.6 tax increase over 10 years, now down to $1.4.
Mm-hmm.
Those don't include payroll tax increases. That's already $1.4 to $1.6 trillion. You add a payroll tax increase, it goes higher.
You mean ending the payroll tax holiday? Or
no, just,
more than
just,
that?
Just more than that, to solve the solvency crisis by increasing the 12.4% we pay in payroll to something higher. That's not going to pass the House. It's a question we can talk about, but we're having a hard time even getting this deal through, if there even is a deal. And I think what's something that Bob is hitting on, and Henry too, which I think is important, is the idea of these so-called millionaires, billionaires, and what we do. And
could we fix it with a little heavier taxes there that they could afford?
You can do a first step. It wouldn't completely fix it by just taxing those people, unless you actually raise the payroll tax completely, as Henry said. But what I would like to point out is one of the things I think we could do as well is to help those. Instead of just raising the payroll tax and saying, okay, we've solved the solvency crisis, we've done nothing then to help those at the lower end. What I'd rather see something happen is we do something that changes and increases the minimum benefit for those who really need it at the lower end of the income spectrum and the mm-hmm. retirement spectrum, and then curtail it for those at the high end.
So if you're a billionaire, you won't draw that $1,000 a month and you don't need it.
It'd be like $2,300, and you definitely don't need it. Let's pull it down. For someone like me who right now is planning on working longer, I'm fortunate enough to be able to work in an air-conditioned office,
yep.
not a blue-collar laborer on the
yep.
street.
Yep.
I want to make sure they actually have a strong benefit when they retire. I've got a pension. I've got a 401k. I've got savings. You can reduce mine and use that savings to bump theirs up, and we can still do that in the context of a changed CPI.
We'll look at that. Sherry in Des Moines, Iowa. You're on the air, Sherry. Thanks for calling.
Well, hi, Tom. Hi. I appreciate getting a chance to bring this up. You know, the changing the index and expecting the average person to change their behavior is, again, I think what makes us makes me livid and causes enormous frustration and hardship for everybody in the 98%. I mean, you talk about Social Security. What we shouldn't be talking about is a change in the index, and I'm happy to hear there's a surplus, although I'll be close to 80 in 2033. And what I'd like to see is some equitable changes in the rates that people pay. I mean, right now, roughly...
In payroll tax, who pays how much into it?
$110,000. Yep. Dollar income, they pay 6.5%, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And then there's a cap, and people pay nothing after
right.
that.
Right.
You know, so somebody making $200,000, their rate isn't 6 or 6.5%; it's 3%.
So most Americans, so again, of course, 50,000 something, they're going to pay on all their income, but wealthier people are just going to pay on part. So you say, what, tax people on all their income?
Their rate goes down, and here we have another inequitable revenue collection.
Sherry, our time is short. Let us pick it up right there. Henry Aaron, what about that? You know, you hear Jason says, well, on the payout side, don't pay out to people who are rich when they retire. They don't need it. Sherry says on the pay-in side, tax people on their full income, not just the first 100,000+. Are solutions there, Henry?
Fixing the long-term imbalance in Social Security is a straightforward and comparatively easy thing to do. Through a combination of different changes in taxes, one could get all the way there. If, as a result of required political compromise, benefits have to be cut somewhere, I think the last caller pinpointed where the benefit or Jason did, actually,
mm-hmm.
also,
yes.
where the benefits cuts should be. It should be at the very top of the earnings distribution. Let's be clear. Historically, the payroll tax has covered as much as 90% of all the earnings in the United States. It's several percentage points below that. We could raise the payroll tax base so that it covered the same proportion of earnings it has done in the past.
But what would that
we could
mean,
raise
up
the payroll tax
30 or 40,000.
Well, actually, gradually over time, it would go a little higher than that. But mm-hmm. you could do it in little tiny steps each year. If you raise the payroll tax a half a percentage point each on workers and employers, we're not talking about a huge bite. That combination of moves would get you very close to closing that long-term deficit that Jason referred to.
Hank, do you think this
and
change
if some
in
additional...
the index, is this going through? We've got half a minute here. Is it going through? Are we going to see, you know, a smaller Social Security checks down the road because of what happens in the next 10 days?
I think this is a bad provision that is probably going to go through.
Jason, you agree?
I'm actually not sure. I think if you have to quiz me today, right now, I think we're going actually over the fiscal cliff, and we're not going to see any kind of deal until after January 1.
Bob Cutner, what's your prognosis?
If the liberals stick to their guns, and that includes President Obama, Social Security does not need to be cut by one nickel.
Listeners, there it is. It's on the table. It's your country. Now you see the picture, and, well, we'll see where she goes. Harry Aaron at the Brookings Institution, it's wonderful to have you with us today. Thank you so much for your insights and your time, Henry.
Thank you very much.
And Jason Fichtner at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Jason, Mr. Fichtner, thank you so much.
Thank you, sir, and thank you for the discussion.
Robert Cutner, co-editor of the American Prospect. Good to see you, Bob. Thank you so much for coming.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. Be alert. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.